This is Game Theory, a podcast about competition, strategy, and decision-making, hosted by me, Nick Andrews, and my brother, Chris. In this episode, we're selling our stocks and going to the beach. The decades-old adage, sell in May and go away, means exactly what it sounds like. Sell your stocks, put your money somewhere else, and come back around in the fall. It means the stock market performs better in the months between October and April. The reasons for this performance shift have been studied and guessed at, but the adage remains the same throughout the years. The saying and its investment strategy likely started as an observation that turned into advice, like a rule of thumb, perhaps. But now that everyone knows about it, does that mean it's not a great strategy anymore? Does the knowledge of the idea make it worse? Or maybe better? And welcome to episode 112 of Game Theory, podcast about competition strategy and decision making. Chris, we went to your bachelor party over the weekend and we had some competition and some strategy, and there was some decision making as well. And I gotta say, you're bad at like stuff.
Let's elaborate on that accusation real quick.
So at Chris's bachelor party, we played, I call them the husband games, the 74th annual husband games, not the Hunger Games, the husband games. Where we did dumb stuff, like we just picked a random distance and thought, like, how far do you think 40 yards is? How far, which you got right. That was the best, that was your best moment. So you got with 120 feet within, like, inches, which was sick,
within,
but then we did.
Oh, no, within, like, fractions of an inch.
Yeah, it was pretty good. But then we did a laundry relay, we did Stein holding, we did a bunch of stuff, and you lost. You didn't, and there was eight of us, and you took last twice.
Yeah, we had winners per event, and we had different heats in those events, so it was like an aggregate score. Nick, I forget, how many times did you win an event? I lost count.
Zero times. Zero wins.
Yeah, okay. That's
zero wins, there's zero losses. I'm adequate.
Yeah, you were one of the competitors of all time. It was a good showing, I thought.
It was.
The group did really well. We had a fun time together. That's the important thing. This is like, it's like that Mike Leach quote about the JC softball team. Whoever wins is the one that has the most fun.
You never wanted to take last because Chris thought the punishment for taking last would be to do a room temperature shot of something called 99 bananas, which is flavored liquor stuff, like food stuff. It's basically like the liquor version of what's in hot dogs. Disgusting. And you lost twice.
I've ever tasted.
It was
bad.
Horrible. And then we all watched the closest Kentucky Derby of all time.
Oh, man.
Insane.
Well, none of us knew about the Kentucky Derby until I think you found it.
We Googled it.
Scroll on your phone.
Yeah.
We completely forgot. You know, it was the first weekend in May. Right. So the Derby was on. And incredible finish. Who was the winner again? Dan or Magical Dan or something?
Mystic Dan, yeah. Mystic Dan. But Mystic, it could have been Forever Young, who I bet on. Which I bet on? Horses are things.
I
bet on.
Break it to you. Animal.
People. Yeah.
Well, there was some controversy at the end. As you saw, Sierra Leone, which took second place.
Right. An uncomfortable name for a horse.
Well, the jockey for Sierra Leone reached down and it looked like he was like in some way illegally contacting Mystic Dan, like the other horse that he was not riding. And so I think the jockey has been suspended, and I don't know if that means for the standings. I didn't look into it that deeply, but it was like a nose finish. And the first thought we had was, I think it was you who were the first to say it aloud. It was, this is just going to be terrible for all the LinkedIn conversations about it,
and like high school people, athletes, like all the coaches are gonna be like, look at the little things. Like,
I mean, and unfortunately it's a really great way to live your life, because a little bit of effort, just a little bit of extra, would have made the difference this time. And what that's going to do for conversations about B2B sales is
the inside joke there, of course, if you didn't see, was that some guy proposed to his girlfriend and wrote the top 10 things that proposing to my girlfriend taught me about B2B sales, which was just the most bleh thing to ever do. On and it is hardcore interneting, and now LinkedIn is infiltrated. Like, is LinkedIn dead? Well, maybe we'll do a conversation on that later. But that's your joke. Yeah, no, that was my first thing I thought. I was like, man, for middle management and for high school coaches, this is going to be annoying for at least a year. But look at this, because it wasn't just a nose between two horses. It was a nose between three, which is crazy. That's like the most ridiculous thing. What a 150th. Also, as a big sports fan, horse racing seems like it's on the way out. Really horrible things they do to those animals. It's getting worse. They're all inbred at this point. It's just not the cool sport that it used to be. The steroids are putting horses down. Like, something like dozens have died after racing in I forget what it's called in California. Yeah, so that's a little, we'll have to deep dive that later. But yeah, the Kentucky Derby was great. Bachelor party was great. You were bachelored up. Couple weeks to trim off those 5 pounds before the wedding. Those pictures are forever. Been there, done that. Enjoy that.
Well, yeah, the pictures are forever, but I think we all know that the results are not necessarily there forever unless you're consistent with them. Mm. I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know. My pictures are forever, and they look great. The pictures from my wedding are awesome. 10 out of 10 recommend those. But, Chris, we are here to talk about sales cycles, in particular the stock market sales cycles. But before we do that, we need to talk about Elon Musk, who is doing something really, really shitty that I can't, which, I mean, Chris is like, I don't know what he's going to say here, but I probably agree that this is horrible. There are Teslas that in the last, I think, 6 months or so have been sold that the customer believes that the battery range is somewhere between 250 and 260. However, it isn't. It's about 320 to 350, but Elon has locked that battery range unless the customer pays for an upgrade.
Yeah, the scary thing about driving around electric vehicles that are basically just computers that have wheels on them, I mean, it I don't know what the safety record is. I don't know if it's any safer or less safe. I think the autopilot thing is really scary, that puts a huge, like, heavy machinery into the hands of a computer. And by the way, when people, like, I personally think that when you read on those medicine labels, like, people who take this shouldn't operate heavy machinery for 12 hours. I always think, like, oh, okay, well, I'm not going to go around and, like, drive my forklift then. Like, if I was working in a job where I had to operate, like, heavy machinery, then I wouldn't do it. But that means a car. A car is considered heavy machinery. And so you're handing that over to, like, a bot, basically. The real scary thing about these electric cars and computerized systems to me is, like, you gotta pay for a lot of extra stuff. I mean, the company is just licensing out this car to you. And if you don't pay for all the software upgrades, then they can, like, lock your car and prevent you from using it. So you just have this big chunk of bricked material that doesn't really do anything. And, like, Tesla's on the bleeding edge of that. I can't think of any company that's gone from the height of status to just the pit of uncool and weird hero worship faster than Tesla has.
Yeah, the Cybertruck, if you haven't looked into it, is horrible. It's actually impressive to make something that not only looks like a video game, but also is just, like, completely irrelevant. Like, in terms of off-roading and functionality, you would literally rather have just a normal Tesla. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible feat of engineering. It's an absolute joke. And you can look it up. There are whole threads and TikTok accounts dedicated just, like, hey, look what the Cybertruck did today. It's bad. But this in-app purchase thing, we've talked about it before in the world of gaming. It's getting wild. And what's the point of Congress if not to prevent in-app purchases from my streaming services? Let's get them. If you can't do anything else, let's just get rid of that. Huh? Do you need to sell ads? Do you need to sell ads in Peacock? 30-second ads? That's your revenue? Those people and the products that I'm not going to buy. Do you ever watch YouTube and you get an ad that's like 15 seconds and you can't skip it? And you're like, you know what? I'm going to mute this and turn away. I'm not participating.
Every time. Yeah, every time. I do that for cable as well. So we're rapidly converging on this. Is this the same thing we had before? But now the streaming services have just injected commercials. I think it was Peacock that had the gall to say, enjoy this program commercial free immediately before playing a commercial.
Yeah, that's
it. Was like, we put the commercial up front, so the program is commercial free. It's like, no, that's a direct insult to my intelligence, but it's not insulting enough for me to cancel the service. So it's like, who's the real sucker here?
I was watching something on, I don't know, Hulu or Amazon or something that had ads just a couple of years ago. And it said in my binge, like the fourth episode in the binge or whatever, this is a commercial-free episode brought to you by Target. And I was like, you know what, Target? Thank you. And just said it like in a little banner. Like, yep, perfect. Perfect marketing. This is just the good vibes I need to not hate you. Okay, let's get into the stock market, Chris. So my biggest flex on people is that I bought $50 worth of NVIDIA in 2016 when it was trading at like $14 a share. Still have it. I don't know what it's trading at now, but I know that I keep getting notifications from my investor app called Stash to buy more. That's my biggest flex. I was like, NVIDIA, I don't know what that is. Screw it. And it was horrible for years. And then now it's exploded. But according to an old adage from Stock Traders Almanac or something, it is May as we release this. It is time to sell in May and go away. And what that means, if you've ever heard that, is for conventional wisdom, and we'll get into it, sell your portfolio if you're a day trader or a week trader or like a trader. Sell your portfolio, put them into more stable assets, i.e. gold and real estate, and come back around in the money spending season, which is typically in the fall and in October. Now, that is true and has panned out to be true and remains semi-true-ish, but it's also in this weird spot where, because people know it's true, does it prevent them from doing it, or does it add fuel to the fire?
Before I talk about this, I want to be absolutely clear about something. Mm-hmm. We are not offering financial advice.
Yes.
Nothing that we can say on this episode should be, can be by a reasonable person, like, will ever be construed as financial advice.
Do Let me take it a step further. From us. We are not offering advice.
We're not offering advice at all.
Yeah, yeah, no. Absolutely Please. Not.
You know, we're talking about an interesting phenomenon that we found that deals with the stock market and deals with finances. This is not advice. Do not trace this back to us, please.
Yes.
However, it is interesting that we have a phrase that rhymes and seems to have some truth in it. Sell in May and go away. Do you ever watch the Lego movie?
No, I haven't watched the Lego movie, but I heard it checks out. It's like a really good movie.
I was asking that rhetorically. I just assumed that everybody had seen it.
I've seen it through clips on the internet, I think. You know what I mean? You know exactly what I'm talking about?
There's a great line in there, the character voiced by Morgan Freeman. Mm. It's like, yeah, this prophecy must be true because it rhymes.
I got a good rhymer for you. At what date does corn need to be at least knee-high to be a soluble product?
I don't know, 4th of July?
Knee-high by the 4th of July.
Yep. Yeah. So we're dealing with a rhyming adage here.
Yes, which is helpful.
I'm just going to get the basic definition of what this is, because you've kind of mentioned it before. So we're going to go to our trusty friend Investopedia for what the definition is here. And they say, sell in May and go away is a well-known saying in finance. It is based on stocks' historical underperformance during the six-month period from May to October. And Investopedia and the other sources that I've seen trace this back to the Stock Traders Almanac, which, and I'm quoting from Investopedia again here, it found investing in stocks as represented by the Dow Jones Industrial Average from November to April and switching into fixed income the other 6 months would have produced reliable returns with reduced risk since 1950. So the idea is that in the summer months, when the weather gets warm and everyone's out vacationing or doing whatever else, they suggest you should get out of the stock market because it just underperforms. It's just not as good. The returns just aren't steady. And I guess there's some truth to that.
Yeah, there is definitely some truth to that. So we'll just go over the facts for now. Investopedia has been a great source for game theory, and it is a great source for just baseline stock and trading and money advice, savings, and that kind of stuff. It's similar to like NerdWallet or Bankrate if you use any of those. And it's really great. So here are the data. S&P 500 index. So the Stock Traders Almanac, this goes back to like the 1950s, and we'll get into like how, you know, the chicken or the egg argument of this. But since 1990, the S&P 500 has gained about 2% from May to October. So the magic number for like your IRA and a bunch of other stuff is 7%. If you're making 7% year over year, that is the trajectory that you want to be on in a compounding interest kind of way. That's the goal. 2% is really bad compared to that. It is an underperforming market, which underperforming is an official designation. There are other official designations like moderate sell, weak hold. That so underperforming means it's performing, but it's exactly like it sounds. So 2% is bad. That is compared to the magical 7% number from November to April. This is according to Fidelity Investments. So we find out that even since 1990, which is long after the invention of the Stock Traders Almanac, this has been a thing. And there are some numbers that we'll get into in a little bit that show that in years of financial crises, it's super duper true that selling in May and going away is helpful, with the exception of the pandemic year, which was all herky jerky and a bunch of other interesting terminology. That was a fun year for stock traders. But it's 7% in the winter months compared to 2% in the summer. Now, in my opinion, there are a couple of factors at play here that I just kind of know about a little bit, and a couple of them are obvious. Thing number one is that everybody has to pay taxes, file taxes, or gets a tax return, and nobody knows what to do that. Thing number two is that the summer months are when people change housing quite a bit. Essentially from mid-April to about September is when people move. That's when I've almost always moved. I've almost never not moved in that cycle. That's true. Regardless of your age, regardless of your financial status, regardless of your marital status, that's when people move. And I think that kind of has a lot to do with it as well.
Well, I want to check in. Let's on that. Back. So it's interesting that you tie that into moving. So the tax season makes sense to me. So everybody knows that the deadline to file your taxes is usually April 15th or close to there if it's like on a weekend or something. Occasionally the IRS will extend that deadline depending on if it's a holiday. Obviously things had to change during COVID because people had difficulties with the pandemic hitting almost exactly a month before that in the US. So things change around a little bit, but generally speaking, people file their taxes close to the deadline in April. And I don't know what that necessarily means there. I mean, obviously, people at places like Fidelity and other investment firms, they've made the connection between the adage and the tax deadline. But right. The actual effect of the tax deadline on this kind of cyclical observation of markets underperform in the summer, I don't know if it's especially clear. But I want to talk about the moving thing, because you pointed out you've almost always moved during the summer months. And I think the most regular calendar that most of us are connected with, I mean, there's like things like church calendars and, you know, the Gregorian calendar. Okay, that's fine.
Of course.
But the school system calendar plays academic. A big part in this. Yeah, as the academic cycle goes, I mean, everybody in America is required to go to school. Everybody in America has to spend years of their lives going to school and then basically leaving for the summer, unless you live in specific places that have kind of year-round schooling. It's not the same for everybody. You know, there's like school starting up season in the September-ish time frame. Yeah. There's school exit season in the late May to June time frame or whatever. But the suggestion here that I have is, well, I guess the question for you is, do you think your moves have been tied to the summertime for reasons that are not related to school?
I think everyone's move. Well, I think everyone's move is tied to it.
Well,
I'll tell you what.
Your moves have always been, I mean, mostly based on like your personal life, right? And your wife has been on like a cyclical school-based calendar because of the extensive education that goes with being a medical professional.
No question. So, there's more to it than that. And I think it's because I think that what you're saying is at the root of this moving thing. And that has to do with selling as well. Like if you're invested in the market and you need a little bit extra cash, I really do think this is more a result of the housing market than it does anything. And I guess we'll just go down this rabbit hole right now. So if we agree.
I did just Google it real quick. According to movinglabor.com, which that sounds reasonable to me. I asked, when is the peak moving season? And the answer on this page is, quoting here, peak moving season occurs in the summer, with 80% of all moves in the United States occurring between April and September.
Well, follow my train of thought here. If the academic calendar spurs moves, and then you get out of college and you need to move again, and then eventually that will impact demand, which is, once the domino is trickled down on the demand impact, it just keeps going and going and going forever. I have on my screen a table from Bankrate. The numbers we're looking at on the left-hand column is the month, and on the right-hand column is the seller premium, and that is like the income, or not the income, the value on your house that it increased when you sold it, how much more you get compared to market value. The top 4 months for the best time to sell your house and when you're going to get the most money for it are, in order, May, June, April, March, July.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that has to do with, right, and then that's when you're moving, right? So it goes all the way back to March, which of course is springtime, but that's preparing for the calendar. The three most, the only ones that are 10% improvements, are May, June, and April. Like, that's, when did you move?
Well, my most recent move was in February, actually. So.
Which is, but you didn't buy, though.
No, I did not.
You're renting.
This is not home buying. So according to this, then the best time for someone to buy a house would be November, winter. December. Of course, that's really inconvenient. I mean, it's cold out depending on where you live.
Right.
And it's also like getting into the holiday season. Like, what would you rather do? Enjoy a nice homegrown, you know, family meal with your friends and loved ones around Thanksgiving? Or would you rather be uprooting your entire life and moving into a new place?
Yes. And that's sort of the deal. Like, I think that this is tied completely to the housing market. However, it has been a thing forever. This is in an almanac. It's one of those old timey sayings that people kind of understand. And I have dabbled. I don't say I day trade. I micro trade where I just like,
you don't day trade.
No, I don't day trade.
No,
but I do have, I own shares of shares. Like, this is an easy thing to do and not as risky because you can diversify so much more aggressively. And I unload a lot of them in May because I heard this adage and I was like, those people know more than me. Fuck it. I'm selling them. And I do that all the time and it works. And I will go buy a golf club or something and enjoy my returns. And I buy again before the market in September and get in for the holiday rush when everyone's trying to, you know, make their get to the black. It works. It's a thing. I'm telling you, it is an absolute thing. But there are some CEOs on Wall Street that are saying, please don't do that. I wonder why they're doing that, Chris.
Yeah, who could know what the motivation is of executives on Wall Street to get people to not sell and leave the market?
I can't possibly fathom.
It's a great big mystery. And I assume you're referring to an article published this week, earlier this week, on May 7th. This is from investing.com's Sam Bugetta.
Mm.
Sorry if I mispronounced that. S&P 500 don't sell in May and go away. Bank of America. Analysts at Bank of America told investors in a note Tuesday not to sell in May and go away, as statistical data shows that presidential election years can see big summer rallies.
Wow.
So here we are.
That's so impressive.
Yes. Like, well, the presidential election, who knows? We're going to have a big rally because we're going to be casting ballots in the fall. So that means in June, don't sell your stocks. Please keep buying stuff. Yeah. Crazy. Crazy that a banker would want people to keep buying products.
Yes. Their products. They do have a point, according to the analysis from Bank of America that they published for themselves. So this is what they published. Going back to 1928, the S&P 500 is up 65% of the time, higher than an average return of 3.2%. Again, underperforming. Meanwhile, a not as cool word for however, in presidential election years, the S&P 500 is up 75% of the time. So 10 more percent of the time from June to August because of a presidential election year. If I've learned anything over the last two presidential elections is that we should always compare presidential elections to past ones, for sure.
Well, yeah. The thing that makes the comparison justifiable is that every presidential election is the most important one of our lifetime.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that's true again this year.
Decision.
This is the most important one. Decision 2024, the most decision. Important. Yeah.
The future.
Player three, get your ass to the polling place and cast your ballot. Good Lord. You have a civic responsibility to this country. Get your ass to the polls and vote. That's it. That's PSA. But
yes.
I am interested. I don't think you mentioned this. So according to the Bank of America analysis, in regular years during the summer, S&P 500 is up 65% on average, on an average return of 3.2%.
Mm-hmm.
But then in June to August, in presidential election years, that average return is 7.3%. Am I right
yes.
in understanding that the returns are more than twice as high in presidential election years?
On average, yes, 75% of the time. So understanding that is a little weird, but for me, it seems like the way to interpret that is that 75% of people can experience that, or 75% of market players can experience that, but not necessarily everyone will. I think that there is a tremendous amount of spending involved in running a presidential campaign. Yeah. There's also a lot of fear buying. So, for example, we know that guns and ammunition in 2008 was like the best year ever ahead of the Barack Obama's momentum, right? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, because people were unjustifiably terrified that Barack Hussein Obama was going to confiscate all the guns. And it was, I remember it was mm-hmm. like years in Wyoming where we lived that 22 ammo was on back order at like all the sporting goods stores. You had to
Yeah.
Go out of town, basically, if you're going to try to buy any. Mm-hmm. People just stocked up so much because they were worried that, you know, Big Bad Barack was going to come into town and take all the guns. And obviously that didn't happen. Obviously that was an unjustified fear. But, you know, people really panicked about it. They spent a lot of money because they were concerned about what was going to happen in the presidential election.
Yeah. And like that kind of thing, I think, is where this is coming from. I'm not 100% sure that it has anything else to do with that. And that's not a really a predictable way to get and invest your money. Like, what are, you know, former President Trump and President Biden, what are they scaring people into buying? I don't know. And it doesn't really matter in terms of like what is predictable. And that's kind of insider trading. And of course, we have Twitter accounts and services like Unusual Whales now, who completely track Congress people, and you can kind of piggyback on their trades. Those beat market averages by like a shit ton. It's better than your IRA, kind of like those are incredibly, incredibly safe investments to just do whatever the Congress people are doing, which is a different conversation. I do want to point out that this is not just an American thing. I don't have the complete data because I don't have a JSTOR subscription, but I should get one. I should get a library card. I need to get a library card, dude.
We should invest.
You know what I mean?
That should be let's calculate what the ROI is for us on a JSTOR subscription.
Yeah. Have a library
card.
You
know what ROI means if you studied business, of course, the number one business
school. I would know that if I had studied business. This is my favorite time of year on TikTok when I get to see all of the STEM majors out there, still all the kiddies stressed out about finals, compare what their finals are to like the education, HR, and business majors. And they're like, why am I doing this to myself? This is super not that much fun. Well, that was you, right?
I mean, the key to understanding college is that the people who have the most fun are also the people who are going to be signing the paychecks and making the most money. So really, just go to business school and learn how to do Excel and you're going to be fine.
I know. It's Excel.
Once again, we're not offering advice, but just do that.
just do that. Anyway, so a Redditor summarized the paper that is published in JSTOR, which was published by Bauman and Jacobson in 2002. The sell in May and go away effect has occurred in 36 out of the 37 countries, mostly in the Northern Hemisphere. 36 out of 37 since 2002 is when this was published. For like decades, this was happening. Mabley and Pierce extended the data to 2003 and tested for a strategy as far back as 1982 through April 2003. It shows out like so much of the Western world or the West, quote unquote, experiences this. I will say that one a Redditor had a theory. This person asks, is the effect the same or reversed in the Southern hemispheres? Because a lot of people tie this back to farming, right? It would make sense. The crops are harvested. Sell until the crops are harvested. That makes a ton of sense. And perhaps there are some legs there. The response to is this flipped in the Southern hemisphere is this distance machine says, quote, it's opposite by because the water goes down the toilet in the other direction. Which, that's not a bad investment strategy, I don't think. Yeah,
genius.
I don't think
that's a bad strategy. Well, my shitter's flushing counterclockwise. It's time to purchase some stocks.
It is.
By the way, did you know that that is a myth?
Chris, why, Jeeves? Why? I don't want to know. I don't want that. That myth makes me happy.
What the hell kind of sense does it make? Like, oh yeah, water only flushes in one direction. No, that only has to do with the design of the flushing mechanism. That has nothing to do with whether it's in the northern or southern hemisphere. People are thinking of that like the Coriolis effect. Like, no, that's on like a huge atmospheric scale. It has to do with like hurricanes. It doesn't have anything to do with you know, flushing your goldfish down the toilet. What direction is it going to spin? Come on, get a grip, people.
So the countries.
Which, and in my opinion, final thought on this, that
okay.
knowing that that's a myth makes this Reddit comment even funnier.
Yes. That is sort of the joke that I got when I read this Reddit comment. I thought, oh, that's probably true.
Yeah, and they probably
just like all Reddit posts, I think to myself, oh, that makes sense. This is true.
Yeah, no, it adds up. I do want to point out that Investopedia has said that, I'm quoting here again directly, the last significant stock market decline during the period from May to October took place in 2011. Remind me, what else was going on in 2011?
My guess would be the entire planet was on the brink of the end of capitalism.
Well, yeah, they were. I don't know if they were on the brink, but
that was 2008.
Like pretty close to the edge.
Yeah.
So the Great Recession was still on in 2011. Like unemployment was still very high. It was still very difficult financial terrain. There was still a lot of bailouts going on. And then the S&P 500 was down 8.1% during that period. So
crazy.
That's a pretty significant dip. Things were still, we were still reeling from the collapse of the housing market in 2007. The S&P 500 declined 0.3% over the same months, for example, in 2015. So just 4 years later, not in a presidential election cycle, I will say, but just 4 years later, there was a, what is this, like a 7.8% difference in the size of the decline of the market during the summer months. It's very cyclical, but it's also very unpredictable. You know, one of the things that one of my buddies who went to business school told me was, like, you know, we do all this modeling, we do all this backcasting, we do all this forecasting, we look at what the data say, we try to have data-driven decisions, and we try to have informed business investment strategies and all this stuff. And he said, look, one of the first things they teach you, and one of the things that you have to base really the rest of your entire business school, like your money management strategy on, is past performance of a market is in no way an indicator of future performance. There is there's no connection between the past results of a market and what it's going to do in the future. So even though we have this cyclical pattern, even though we have connections to things like people move a lot more in the summer months, school gets out and people are changing, like the economy is changing to like seasonal labor, there are a lot of different theories about why this cyclical observation is can be found in the data, but none of them can reliably predict how much or how well that's going to turn out for somebody who decides to invest based on that strategy. And that's a big part of the reason why like money management is like a real profession, why the markets deal with, like, it's completely made up. It's all based on agreement. Like, we have fiat currency and we have, you know, it's just like how much can people agree things are worth. And things are so dynamic in an environment like that. There's no way to reliably predict value, because if there was, fucking everybody would do it. And everybody would be rich and we wouldn't have to worry about these problems. But the reality is that that's not how value works. That's not how exchanges work. That's not how markets work. And there's a lot more to it than this. So investing on rules of thumb like this should probably be informed by other sources of corroborating data and should take into account other factors like, I don't know, are there major social events going on, like a presidential election or a major pandemic that's shutting everything down? You can't play by rules of thumb in a bubble here.
Okay. Yes and no. I don't think that you can play by rules of thumb, but I do want to stipulate that there is some interesting human things going on here, in my opinion. The first is that this is observable beyond culture. Like, Japan is one of the countries outside of the Northern Hemisphere for whom this is, or I guess they're in the Northern Hemisphere, outside of the Western culture.
Japan to be in the West?
No. I said outside the Western culture.
Well, I'm wondering, because I think there's a reasonable argument to be made that, like, I mean, obviously it's Japan. It's not just America 2.0, but it's like, I don't know. They operate in the same kind of basic markets that people in the West do, and they're aligned with the U.S. on
everything that Wyomingites are good at. Japanese are also good at, by the way. I've always told people that.
Yeah, a lot of cowboys out there.
Whiskey and cows and cowboys. They have ski resorts, mountains. Like, it's a lot. It's kind of a misunderstood country in American culture. But I agree. I that's interesting. I think that Japan's kind of its own thing. I think Japan, and then I think China, I consider more of like almost its own thing. It's so big. Sometimes I lump China and India together just kind of geographically, but culturally not the same. I'm aware of the Himalaya.
Yeah.
Himalaya.
I think it's Himalayas.
I think it's Himalayas. Yeah. Anyway, Japan is one of the countries for whom this is true. And culturally speaking, that doesn't make any sense other than when the sun comes up and sun goes down. So maybe it is a farm thing. Do they follow the same strict academic calendar that we do? I know a lot of countries screw around with quarters and trimesters. And yeah, it's a different. Who the hell knows why this is happening?
They don't even follow the same week calendar or week long calendar for academics.
Right.
Yeah. They go to school way more for way more
hours. That's what I'm saying. So, like, this has to be older than that. Maybe we don't have strict data for when the Muslim revolution made market trading completely different in the era of Muhammad. Like, who knows how far back this kind of thing goes, but if it crosses into more than just the, you know, the UK, the US and the EU, then there's something here. I will say that there is a chicken and the egg element. There is a Nash equilibrium rock, paper, scissors thing happening here. I know that you know that I know that you know. I have been participating at a small scale with my little, you know, $3 of Microsoft stock and $7 of Nvidia or whatever except for like a couple tech things and a couple big banks, I have been participating in sell in May and go away for years. I have no reason to do that other than I heard it rhyme on a podcast in 2016. And since the 8th May that I've been invested in the market, and I've done it, I guess what I would say at least 6 times for no other reason than I heard it's good advice. So that like the existence of the rhyme is now perpetuating the rhyme. At least in my, you know.
Well, yeah, it is kind of a game theory thing. Yeah. Where, and that's the real connection to why we're talking about this, because like we're obviously not financially illiterate that any other finance podcast is, or any other source of
which ties us for the quality of the advice. I think all podcast bros with white dudes is the equal level of advice.
There's a very low ceiling, and you can approach it very quickly. When it comes to this particular genre.
You should buy. You know what, Player 3? You should buy the stocks that perform well, and you should avoid the ones that don't. That's my advice.
That's good. Yeah, that's really good stuff.
But don't take my advice.
I think it's important to save some money, but also to spend some money.
I agree.
Get some returns on that as
Diversify,
well.
Yeah. But also invest, but don't.
That's right. Yeah, you got to just be smart with your money. I think that's
manifest success. Manifest
success. Okay. All right, we're getting into crazy territory here. I do want to point out, we're talking about a financial system that's largely been dominated by the United States. We should take a look at the, you ever heard of the Bretton Woods Agreement?
Absolutely not. Googling now. So excited. Yeah,
that's like a landmark moment in the history of finance. That was like a post-World War II thing that was like, all right, Bretton Woods is very exciting. I agree with old Cider there.
Yes. She's Cider, my dog. She suspects an intruder. I suspect to have a package being delivered.
Oh, good. Well,
yeah.
I hope it's an enjoyable one. But yeah, the Bretton Woods Agreement is kind of like, that's where modern finance, as I understand it, really took off. It was like an arrangement of the post-war world of people saying, look, we got to figure out how to manage the absolute chaos that the war caused, and how are we going to get, you know, how are we going to rebuild Europe? How are we going to rebuild parts of the world that were really ravaged by war? And so the financial world that we live in is still in the shadow of that, just like the structures and the conventions. And the S&P 500 index, so according to Pennsylvania's insurance department, the S&P 500 has its roots in 1923 when Standard & Poor's started covering 233 companies. But the index as we understand it today has its roots in 1957 when that index expanded to include 500 companies that Standard & Poor's was monitoring. And so that's where it comes from. So 1957 is still, you know, we're still not even 15 years out from really the end of the war. And I think it's like a decade after Bretton Woods. And that modern structure is largely driven by the West. It's largely driven by, you know, European and American kind of financial customs. And so when you talk about how this rule is sell in May and go away, well, yeah, I mean, I guess you can say it's been around for that long,
well,
really since 1950, if the Investopedia data are to be trusted.
And Bretton Woods agreement I'm seeing here spawned two, I guess, stalwart institutions that the entire planet kind of needs to exist in perpetuity now because banks have gotten so big. Two institutions that came out of Bretton Woods, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. Have you ever heard of them?
Yeah, so really critically important kind of interconnecting all of our finances. And like, look, it's been true since the end of the war that our world is increasingly characterized by interrelationship. And so these transnational institutions have an important shaping role in making sure that kind of everybody's financial health is sort of tracking. Of course, that can have negative effects when stuff like housing markets crash, but that's a different story. The point is that when it comes to this adage of sell in May and go away, I mean, the Western drive that created those institutions, like that's really the shaping factor for kind of cyclical patterns that are like this. And when it comes to the game theory of like, all right, if everybody knows about this, then the rule kind of becomes less true. It's like, okay, well, if everyone knows that you sell in, let's just walk through this like game theory style right now.
Okay. Yeah.
If everyone knows that the time to sell is May, well, the savvy among us are going to sell slightly before that. They're going to start selling at the end of April because they know, well, you know, everybody's going to be selling in May, so the value is going to be decreasing as more and more sales go on. So if I get on the early end of that, my sales are going to bring in more money to me.
Right.
If they know that you get it back into the market 6 months later in October, it's like, well, you know, the prices are, they're going to continue to drop, but only so much, because once everybody starts buying, then the demand is going to go up, and that means the prices are going to go up. So I'm going to start my buying back in September. But then the next savvy investor is going to go, well, okay, this guy's selling in late April. I'm going to go to early April, and he's buying in late September. Like, I'm going to go ahead and start buying in August just so I can get ahead of the curve. And you can see how this would just continue to step back and step back and step back. And it's an, yet another example of, if you know when the game is going to end, if you know when the event is going to occur, if you know what the bright line is for your cooperation or defection decision, you can step all the way back. And the best time to start defecting is right now. So yeah. If everybody knows about this, if everybody participates in it, then it doesn't really exist anymore, because logically everybody would start this kind of like sell buy pattern right now instead of waiting for the springtime to roll around.
It's interesting, so because
flatten out in theory.
It is. I think it is a desire for cash too. So when I started micro investing, I really got into it and I believed in the idea that owning a portion of a stock that would perform well, diversified across a bunch of different things, was good for me. And I have the returns. I made well above 7. I made about 11%, and it absolutely helped me fund my wedding. And every year I would sell about half of what I owned and I would get cash, because the returns were far better than a savings account. And in the boom years of the post Obama, the postmodern Obama, you know, saved the world from the brink of disaster stuff, the market was going really well. I wanted to be involved. It was better than a savings account. And I would earn a couple $100 from my winter investing. And for someone who was making, you know, $40,000 in his first big boy job, that was a ton. And it was summertime and I wanted to spend it. And this podcast was like, yeah, this is a good time to cash out. I will say that the success that I've had doing this has largely been by buying things consistently when I get my paycheck and then ignoring them. And then when I look at the ones that have made the most money in May and I think, fuck it, that's good enough. I'd like to go to the beach for Memorial Day, and I sell. That has been how I've done this. If people think like me, except for it's not just $200 to go down the shore, it's like a couple hundred thousand to buy a house, it is a completely different scale for 20 million people invested in the market. And the only things I wouldn't sell were products that I believed in, where I was like, yeah, this is good. I don't know. Stocks go up, they go down, whatever. I remember the ones that I made the most money on were NVIDIA and Microsoft. And this was literally my thought process. With NVIDIA, it was the cheapest highly rated tech stock in the pre-rated tech stocks in my app. That was it. Didn't even Google it. Didn't know what they did there in California. Didn't care. The other one I bought was Microsoft. I bought a lot of Microsoft because all of the nerds that I worked with in graphic design and all the creatives with the Adobe products, they were like, actually, I switched from MacBook to Surface Pro. And I was like, you know what? That makes sense. I'll get a Surface Pro. I'll buy Microsoft stock. Didn't even think about it. And then I sold in May, went away and spent a couple $100. But if people continue to do this cycle the way that you're discussing, theoretically, there's not going to be any cyclical nature to this. And we're seeing that there kind of is, but there kind of isn't. Nobody knows. You can make data do anything that you want when you look backwards at it.
Yeah, it's like you can torture the data to explain. If you interrogate via torture, it will spit out anything that you want to hear. So yeah. this backward recursion of, if you know what the deadlines are, the time to defect is right now. In theory, if everybody kind of participated in this, then nobody would be participating in it. It would be self-defeating.
Right.
And it kind of reminded me, I don't know about the mathematical soundness of this, but it reminded me of two things. One of them is the old Yogi Berra-ism. I don't think he originated it, but he definitely popularized it. When talking about, like, you know, some location, he goes, oh yeah, it's too crowded, nobody goes there anymore.
Yep.
Like, well, if nobody's going there, then how the hell is it crowded? So
that's a really good one, because definitely noticed, like, I went to Nashville with some friends a couple weeks ago, maybe about a month ago, and we were out Broadway. It was good weather finally. And they somehow sniffed out a bar that had darts and a couple of video games that was completely empty amid the just chaos of everybody at all these bars. Like, I don't know how they did that, but there's a place where, like, if the vibes are off, the vibes are out. Like, there is a correct, honestly, you know who we need? This is just me brainstorming right now. I want to get a fraternity president, a former fraternity president, because I saw a TikTok. You would love this. I saw a TikTok of how to have the perfectly attended party. If you're having a frat, like, how do you get people to show up, and how do you get, like, the not too many, but enough people? And he said they would pay some of their friends like $10 or whatever and get them in who weren't in the frat to show up at a specific time so that it seemed like it was always going up. It seemed like it was going up. And so that it would, like, okay, party starts at 3 p.m. or whatever on a Saturday. Then there's like no one there. They'd be like, okay, we need 7 people at 3 p.m. And then at 3:15, we need 7 more people. And then, like, they would do the, and then the people at the beginning, they could leave. It wouldn't matter. At that point, the word of mouth marketing was getting out. But I think that's exactly what happened with meme stocks like GameStop, right? You sell GameStop and go away. That's the point of this, is that the market is just based on vibes so much. I'm participating in the vibes. Does that make me part of the problem or solution? Am I benefiting or am I being stupid? You know?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the frat boy example tells you that there are other factors at play. It's not the not the timing that matters. It's the influence of getting people to come at a certain time. Like, we're, rather than letting this observation be the rule that we're following, we're actually creating the rule by doing some other thing. That's why the presidential election has such an outsized influence on disrupting the size of the disparity between the 2 6-month periods. That's why the coronavirus and the pandemic that followed had such an outsized influence. Like, yeah, that's bigger than this little rule of thumb. It also brought to mind this thing, and I'm going to share this with you. This is kind of, I think, one of the classic examples of false correlation or correlation that does not equal causation. I think I first saw this, I want to say, in Freakonomics. In Player 3, withhold your judgment on that, because I'm not a Freakonomics stan, but you know, I think there's some interesting stuff here.
I'm a fan.
The example here is, we've got an ad. The example here is polio rates plotted against ice cream sales in 1949. So check this
nice.
Out. So we've got January to December. We've got the shape of this curve. And as the weather gets slightly warmer, there's a small dip in April. But as the weather gets warmer, we get more ice cream sales. And right into August, like, that's when it's the hottest. It keeps going up until August, and then it declines as we get into the later parts of the year. And there's almost a mirror image, or almost an exact mapping of the number of polio cases to the number of ice cream sales. And I've already kind of given away the ghost here a little bit, but if somebody looked at this and said, oh yes, well, the more ice cream we sell, the more polio we get, that must mean that ice cream in some way causes polio, because polio doesn't cause ice cream sales. I'll tell you that right now. Mm. But the real factor here is, like, there's something else that's missing from this picture. And that thing is warm weather. So polio as a virus survives better in warmer weather. People are less likely to contract it when it's cold, because they're staying indoors, or they're staying away from each other, and there's not as much transmission. Whereas in the hot months, people are outside, they're going into public places, they're going into public pools, they're doing whatever it is that people do in the summer, and that is causing transmission of polio cases. And oh, by the way, people eat a lot more ice cream in the heat of the summer than they do in the cold of December and January. They're eating a lot less of it during the cold months. So this is the classic example. These two things are very closely correlated, but there's no causal relationship, because they're both independently related to some other driving factor, which is the temperature and the condition of the weather outside.
Yeah. Correlation and causation is part of the deal. And you're like, okay, if I don't eat polio, if I don't eat ice cream, am I not going to get polio? That's not true at all. What it means is that if you're looking for things, you will find them. But doesn't mean I'm not going to sell in May and go away. I think that there are factors involved there. And I do get suspicious from the big media apparatus, because I've been a part of it, that if you were writing a story about selling in May and going away, nobody with a stock price at their company would possibly comment on that. They would never want that. However, I do know that layoffs often happen in the fourth quarter and the first quarter, because people have to get in the black, and a good way to do it is to fire people, and then they'll get in the black and their stock will go up, right? It makes a ton of sense. Additionally, each company that you're looking at from a stock market value situation is its own thing. I'll give you an example. Like, right now, theoretically on value, you'd be like, okay, well, Boeing is down. Maybe we should buy Boeing. Look, what if you're reading the news that they just had another whistleblower suspiciously die, and 10 more whistleblowers have now been motivated to come forth, which is wild. Two have died, and now 10 are like, these people died. All right, I'll blow the whistle. Fine. I don't know that I would buy Boeing stock, but maybe this is a game theory thing. Maybe you do. Maybe there's a huge sale coming. Maybe Airbus just envelops them. Who knows what's happening? Like, each company is its own thing, no question.
Yeah, we've kind of hinted at this before, but like, kind of a part of the reason that things are converging toward the similar quality, like user interface designs are converging toward the same thing. A lot of restaurant styles are converging toward the same thing. Like, McDonald's is starting to kind of look like every other restaurant, and that trend has been on the way for a long time. A big part of that is that companies like that don't make their money based on the business. In fact, we had an episode discussing the airlines. Like, they actually lose money on every single flight. They're not bringing in enough money to offset the costs of labor, maintenance, and fuel to get flights from A to B. American Airlines loses money every single time they put an airplane in the air. Instead, what they do is they get their money from somewhere else. And usually that has to do with their stock price. I mean, companies, like, all right, maybe they produce a product, maybe they don't. But once you get to a large enough size, it's not about the thing that you do. It's not about the product that you produce. It's about the value you generate in the stock market. And in American Airlines' case, they generate a lot more value in the stock market by getting people to sign up for and participate in rewards programs. Boeing might be a similar story. I mean, obviously, their ability to put together safe airplanes is coming into question, and the rapidity of their death of their whistleblowers is certainly something to be suspicious about. So Boeing, what's the deal? But that doesn't really have anything to do with their stock price, which is based on the agreed value of the people who may or may not invest in that stock, which is why there are so many factors to consider when it comes to making investment choices. And so something as silly as like a rhyming phrase that accurately but flimsily describes the pattern of the value of the S&P 500 from one season to the next, that is definitely not, it is not even close to enough to base a financial decision on. You got to take into account other factors, and you got to also consider that, you know, if everybody's doing this, then there really isn't much of a trend here, and the other factors that underlie it. That's the bedrock of your sound decision making.
No question. And I will say, I can't decide if our recording of this podcast is going to impact my investment strategy. I think my desire for money and when I want that money will impact my investment strategy, just like I would assume most people on planet Earth. It just, when things line up this way, we can look at it and be like, is this a thing that will happen? Or is our inability to understand what will happen clouding our ability to understand what is happening now? And the past stuff, that's just for academia as far as I'm concerned.
Player three, get this phrase out of your mind. Sell in May, go away. Get this phrase into your mind. Listen in May. Continue listening throughout the summer. We got a great summer of content planned. Tell all your friends.
Man, you're not a
poet.
Tell
your friends, friends. Let's keep the ball rolling.
Keep the ball rolling. Subscribe to our YouTube. Got some back episodes coming up to YouTube in a couple of months. And you can see our pretty-ish faces. We could probably both use a razor, I think.
More than one.